Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy, delighted to welcome you all to today's edition of All Sides Weekend, where we talk about books. We are going to learn about what's hot, what you're interested in reading, what you're going to want to know more about. And we're going to know from Mark Maxwell, who is the assistant district manager at Half Price Books. And now I'm told he's lurking in the Lane Avenue store. So if you see a good-looking bearded guy, it's not me. It's my much younger twin, Mark Maxwell. So go and talk to Mark Maxwell when you're there. Robin Nesbitt is the branch manager of the Columbus Metropolitan Library branch in Hilliard, and she is here with the library's Quick Picks. And Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic, and her blog, which is indispensable to anyone who loves books, is The Longest Chapter. Welcome and thank you all for being with us today. We've had a lot of great chatter. We always have a lot of great chatter off mic as we warm up, and I think we're all tired by the time the show begins. So I need game on, okay, with recommendations. Sure. I know we have some shared recommendations today, and I'm looking at Robin Nesbitt's stack that she always brings from the library. And right on the top is a book I just finished that's very much in the news lately, What Happened, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yep.
Let's talk about what happened. Did it happen and what happened, Robin?
I don't. Yeah, it's a good question, Christopher. I haven't read it, so you might know more about this than I do. I was lucky to get this because as soon as it came out, it got swiped off the shelves pretty fast. I meant to look to see what the holds list is, but obviously this is Hillary with her hair down. This is Hillary talking about the election. This is her. And something I heard, you said they thought it was pretty honest because she says she's not going to run ever again. So I don't know. You read it. What did you think about it, Christopher?
I was a little disappointed by it. Yeah. I thought it was a little dull, and I'm not going to get into a political discussion here, except I'm somebody who was very excited by her candidacy.
Right.
I just thought it wasn't, and she makes the point in the book where the people who succeed, this is I'm paraphrasing her, I'm not saying anything on my own, are the ones that tap into the anger.
Mm.
But you don't get any kind of anger from her
right.
in this book. You don't get that kind of edgy energy
right.
in the book. It's more, oh boy, you know, wow, you know,
yeah.
rather than,
right.
you know, that
right.
kind of. And I think I wanted more passion.
Right. Somebody, I did read a review, or heard somebody talk about it and said, you can tell she's a policy wonk because, again, she goes into policy,
you know,
over and over. So for what it's worth, I mean, I think, you know, it's falling off her shelves. I think people are curious. I'm, you know, interesting. I wonder how many people actually get all the way through it. It's a fairly, you know, decent sized tome. So it's over 400 pages. So.
Well, no, she held my attention. I mean, yes, it's over 400 pages, but I'm glad I wanted to read the whole book. And we've all talked about this before. There are other books, either 20 pages or 500 pages. You go, why am I reading this?
Right.
You can't stop. But I'm glad I read this, and I would recommend it to anybody who was a student of politics or the past election,
right.
no matter which way you voted. I mean, I think it's well worth a read. What Happened?
Right.
Perfect, inevitable title
exactly.
by Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Exactly.
And that is a huge Quick Pick at the library.
Yes.
I got it actually off the shelf, and I was floored at the Whetstone branch that there were a couple of copies there. And I asked somebody. Apparently, the library's bought a lot of copies.
Right.
You have to.
Fill
a truck. So.
Yeah. I haven't seen any copies of Hillary. And like I said, this one I came in one day and I knew I was coming on the show. I'm like, oh, I grabbed that really fast because I haven't. It's just been flying off the shelf. So.
Remind us what the Quick Picks are with the Columbus Library.
So Quick Picks are bestsellers that you can walk in and just basically it's your lucky day. Basically, they are if you've had a reserve on something, you can walk in, pick that up. It'll take off your reserve. You get it for 21 days. They do not renew. And yeah, again, typically they tend to be bestsellers. Or even books that the movie's out or people are talking a lot. But again, there's a huge holds list. And so it's encouraging you to come into the library and browse and chat and see us. The new ones always come out Tuesday morning. So if you're really eager to see what's new, come in Tuesday mornings at 9 o'clock.
Be there in line. You have a lot of the really popular Janet Ivanovich, a lot of Clive Cussler.
Oh, yeah.
And P.D. James and people like that are
exactly.
very, but also things that are kind of unexpected as well that you didn't know about.
Absolutely.
So somebody's doing a wonderful job choosing these titles for the Quick Picks. Somebody in the live, I don't know who.
I will pass that along. Her name is Chrissy Harris.
Well, Chrissy, good for you.
Yeah, Chrissy's one of them. We have other selectors too that do it, Tim Thompson and Jennifer Young. I'll give a shout out to my colleagues in the selection unit. So they do a great job. Yeah.
Yep. I want to. You've also got a couple of shared books, and I'm going to ask Cassie Rose to talk about a book that was reviewed in the New York Times last Sunday. I got a very lengthy and very thoughtful review, a book by Alice McDermott, her latest novel, which is called The Ninth Hour. And Alice McDermott is somebody who has been you know, at the forefront of literary fiction for about 20 years now, at least. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, or Cassie, let me ask you to talk about Alice McDermott and The Ninth Hour.
I will say that I love this book. I've been reading Alice McDermott for a long time, way back to one of her first books called That Night, which I absolutely loved. And then I got into the middle of her books, too, and I had to drop off because she has a very distinctive style and you can get tired of it, and I did. And coming back to this book, though, I have to say she's at the top of her game with this book, and it is, I think it's one of her best. And The Ninth Hour refers to the in the hours of praying that the nuns do and the monks do. It's one. It's the afternoon prayer. And this book is based on a group of nuns that are in Brooklyn. They are nursing nuns. It's in the beginning of the 20th century. And it's a time when it was common to see nuns on the streets and going into homes. Yes,
nuns. Right.
Yes, in full habit and swooping into the apartments, into the homes. And these nuns are taking care of the disabled and the lonely and the sick. The center of the novel is about a woman who loses her husband very quickly in the very beginning of the book, and she and her daughter are taken in to the nunnery and working in the laundry. Mm. And the young daughter, Sally, grows up in the convent. And, you know, everything I say about this, it's going to sound so ordinary. And I'm going to be saying, oh, I'm talking about nuns and I'm talking about early 20th century. And people are probably thinking, where's the action? You know, where's the hook? And that's the thing about Alice McDermott. The hook is in ordinary life. Mm. She draws you in to the individual's lives and the hum of them to the point where you feel just enveloped in this atmosphere. It's a novel that you just keep wanting to go back to at night. She calls out the atmosphere. The intrigue, if there is any, is the young girl. And will she become a nun and follow what she has seen growing up? Or will she be doing something else? And she becomes very challenged with it. So I highly recommend this. And if you got tired of Alice McDermott, I would
try that one.
When you say tired of Alice McDermott, what is her theme or her ethos that you would sort of, you know, where does she live as a writer?
She lives in the Irish American Catholic mindset.
Oh, well, some of us.
And okay. But the tiredness, it's not that. It's the style of writing. Mm-hmm. It's very lyric. It is very descriptive. It is very melodic in terms of how it draws you in. You feel like someone is telling you the story. Someone with a beautiful voice is reading to you at night. It's that kind of an atmosphere that you get into. And the world of the Irish Americans and their struggles and as immigrants. And some people, I think that if you read that over and over and over again, for me, I got tired of the style, the rhythm of the narrative. And I thought I was losing my edge as a critic. And that's why I had to pull back.
So you don't get the sense that something physical is going to happen. It's mm-hmm. more the experience. Is that what or the sort of world she creates, as you say, just mm-hmm. what goes on?
It's know? Yeah, exactly. And for me, I couldn't, I can't remember which book it was, but I got to the end of it and I thought, I know this is a good book and I'm not seeing it because I got bored. Mm-hmm. And I got bored because I was tired. It's like hearing the same song over and over and over again, even though it's the perfect song and maybe critically the best. I realized I was losing my edge with her and I had to step away.
Well, another song, that's, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you've come back to this one, The Ninth Hour, which is her latest.
Yes, and I can see she's at the top of her game. This is a beautifully written book. It is a wonderful story where she does bring you again into the ordinary lives of this young girl, Sally, and her mother and the nun who is working so hard in the laundry. And it's also the mindset of these nuns, how they are doing hard work and they are seeing desperate people. And yet they are positive. They are helpful. They believe in what they are doing.
That's the story, how you can live in misery and be a force for good in a way, that which does sound very dated. But that's what they were doing, I think. Yeah.
Exactly. And she brings it out.
Great. I look forward to The Ninth Hour by Alice McDermott. And speaking of The Tenth Hour, Mark Maxwell is here from Half Price Books. You haven't been here for a while, so it's great to have you back because you always have a wonderful way and a great taste of what's hot to read. So hit me. Give me something.
Okay, so I brought with me today probably the hottest book released this week. It is called Turtles All the Way Down by John Green. John Green, of course, is the author of The Fault in Our Stars, which is one of the best-selling young adult novels of all time, made into a blockbuster movie. It's been 5 years since The Fault in Our Stars, so this new novel from John Green has been hotly anticipated. It just came out on Tuesday. I stayed up on Tuesday night to read it, and I found it to be pretty compelling. I don't read a lot of young adult literature. It is John Green, so you have kind of a cast of charming teenagers. I think John Green, in a way, writes aspirational fiction. These are teenagers the way that teenagers would like to see themselves. Mm-hmm. They quote the romantic poets and James Joyce in between arguments about the finer points of Star Wars.
And they bathe, and they're nice to their parents.
They're nice to everyone. They are very nice teenagers, which has not been my general
John's
experience.
From Indiana, so, you know, it's a nice Midwestern boy, right?
In fact, yeah. And in fact, the book is set in Indianapolis, and there's some interesting sort of Indianapolis lore in there.
Well, what grabbed you? Why'd you stay up all night reading this book?
Okay, so what is compelling about this book? It's written in the first person. The main character, Asa Holmes, is a young woman who is suffering from a mental disorder. So she suffers from severe anxiety. She has intrusive thoughts. She's obsessed with microbes and germs, and that affects her in every part of her life. So John Green is bold enough to take us into her head and kind of show us the struggles that she's going through. I mean, the plot itself is not necessarily all that exciting. She's got some friends. She's got a love interest. There's a bit of a mystery going on. She's got a wealthy neighbor who has disappeared in the midst of some legal difficulties. But what is fascinating about this book is the struggles that she goes through on a daily basis. And I think a lot of people who suffer from these problems are going to be grateful to John Green for writing this book. It is a pretty bold and ambitious thing to try to do. And I think in the early reviews seem to indicate that John Green has been pretty successful in dealing with these problems.
Great.
I have seen that book laying around tables, and I've seen that on desks here in this building. Mm-hmm. Younger people, and I've seen a lot of people reading this book. I've seen it all over the library. There's a lot of buzz about it. I haven't picked it up myself. I love The Fault in Our Stars, so mm-hmm. I will
right.
certainly want to look at that. As you say, it's more. Is it more of a mood, or are you? Do you really get into the difficulty that Ava has with
yeah, anxiety? It's harrowing.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Mm. So Turtles All the Way Down. You got to love the title by John Green, recommended by Mark Maxwell, who was the assistant district manager of Half Price Books. We are going to take a break and come back to All Sides Weekend Books here on WOSU 89.7. And I'll have a question for you all in just a moment. Don't go away. We are back. I'm Christopher Purdy. You are listening to All Sides Weekend Books today. We have Mark Maxwell here from Half Price Books, Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, and Robin Nesbitt, the branch manager from the Hilliard branch of the Columbus Library. And Cassie Rose is going to be at Gramercy Books in Bexley on October 24th. It's not her first time there. She will be leading a discussion that has been talked about on a blog that is maintained at Gramercy Books by its owner, and the writer Linda Cass. And the question being asked was, what are the books that changed your life, or what was the book that changed your life? And that question is going to be discussed on October 24th at Gramercy Books, and it's going to be chaired by our own Cassie Rose. So I would like to ask all of you listening today, what was the book or what are the books that changed your life? If you want to share that, I welcome your call, 614-292-8513, or you can send us an email at allsides@wosu.org, and we'll read it on the air. What's the book that changed your life? Cassie Rose, what's the book that changed your life?
Oh, my gosh. You know, when when you've been reading all of your life, there are several books that come to mind. And also, on several levels. So there are changing the life in a quick, funny way. Like I can tell you that The World According to Garp by John Irving is the book that caused me to stop lending my books to anyone.
Yes, I know. By the way, yes. Cassie Rose will not lend you books.
I had a traumatic experience with The World According to Garp when I lent it to someone. And it's not that she didn't just give it back. She just handed it to someone else and it disappeared into the ether and I was traumatized. So there's that level of a book that will change your life. And there's also the level of a book where I could say, Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried changed my life because of what it helped me to see about the Vietnam War. And ever after that, it changed my viewpoint on anything. I wanted to know more and more about the Vietnam War from the viewpoint of the foot soldiers and what really went on. And so it changed me in that way and being historically astute about that and wanting to read about it. And I mean through fiction, whether being Philip Caputo and Larry Heineman, Carl Marlantes.
Phil Klei.
Yes.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah.
And then there are the books that actually do probably change your life. And I can say there is one that comes to mind, which is William Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage, which is his masterpiece. And it's autobiographical. And it changed it because I was at a time in my young life where things were unraveling and I felt unstable. And I was reading it outside the Art Institute in Chicago, where I lived at the time. And this character in the book, the protagonist, Philip, is also struggling. And his friend says to him, his best friend says, you need to go to the Cluny Museum and look at the Persian tapestries on the wall.
In Paris.
Yes, I guess. And he says, you're right. So they must have been in Paris at the time. He says, you need to go there and look at the Persian rugs on the wall. And you are going to see this and this and this and this. And he said, the answer isn't going to come quickly to you, but you will see the meaning of life. Hmm. So then it's several pages later where Philip gets it. And when I was reading that, I mean, it wasn't this profound meaning of life, but what it offered was I realized what I was going through and what was scaring me, and I was afraid of the future. It just said, this is a little part of your life. This is one small scene on this Persian carpet. Mm. And you may have a carpet that's part of your life that is filled with details and all sorts of things going on, or you may be a person where you have a carpet where there are big empty spaces and not much going on. Everybody has their Persian carpet. And for me, reading that at the time and when I was young and I felt scared and isolated, and I was just like, this is one small scene on the carpet. So that is the book that pretty had a profound effect on me. And I did write about it on the blog, gosh, about 8 years ago. And the title of the blog was The Answers in the Carpet.
Of Human Bondage, Somerset Maugham's book. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned
Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried.
Right. Tim O'Brien was part of the Ken Burns' recent Vietnam series as well. So that's a little footnote there. What are the books that changed your life? If you'd like to share, 614-292-8513 or send an email to allsides@wosu.org. Mark Maxwell, what are the books that changed your life?
Well, I actually happened to bring with me a book today that I encountered in a library, my local library, at some point in the mid-80s. It is a science fiction anthology called Dangerous Visions, edited by Harlan Ellison. And this is one of the books that I think kind of guided me in my taste in reading over the years. I didn't return it to the library for about 15 years. So, Robin, I guess you get to get my confession
on
that.
That's all right, right. Exactly.
Harlan Ellison, a lot of the early science fiction writers were primarily magazine writers. They wrote short stories. And, in fact, many of the classic science fiction novels are just collections of shorter pieces. But the magazine business is kind of stifling in terms of the subjects that you can deal with and the language that you can use. And so Harlan Ellison decided that he was going to publish an anthology. He wrote to all of his friends who were a who's who of classic science fiction at the time, and he got them to submit stories that they wouldn't be able to submit to the magazines for whatever reason, because of the subject matter, because of the language. He put those stories together into an anthology called Dangerous Visions. There are stories here. It's published in two volumes. There are stories here by Kurt Vonnegut, Ray Bradbury, Fritz Lieber, Theodore Sturgeon, just about every major figure in science fiction is writing stories that are kind of pushing the envelope of what it was possible to do. And Ellison introduces each of the stories with a long and sort of self-indulgent introduction in which he talks about the writer. And it's a really great introduction to classic science fiction. There's no textbook for science fiction, but I would nominate Dangerous Visions by Harlan Ellison as a pretty good one.
And just quickly, when did you first read that book? What point in your life did you encounter that book?
I was a kid. It was like 1984, and it's still one of my favorite books.
And Robin Nesbitt, with all the books that you, well, both of you, are all three of you are drowning in books in a good way all the time. What book changed your life?
I have to go back even younger than Mark. I was probably 8 or 9, Harriet the Spy by Louise Fitzhugh. So I'm a kid growing up in Morrow County, Mount Gilead, Ohio. I'm surrounded by farms, and I am taken by this vision of an 11-year-old kid living in a brownstone in Manhattan. And it just, I mean, it was just a different world. I must have read this book over 100 times. I remember the very first copy that I read fell apart, and I rebound it myself. I took it out to my dad's Vice Grips, and I had put a new cover on it, and I like rebound it. I've bought it 2 or 3 times. I've had people buy it for me. I have it as an ebook, but I think it just opened my mind up to the possibilities of there's other things. Thinking about carpets, like my life just doesn't have to be here in this farming community, that I could do and be and so yeah, I just read it over and over.
It's the gift of books for children, that you can do or be anything you want.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah. And I suggest it all the time at the branch, because especially for young females, she's a strong female character. She knows her own mind. She doesn't take a lot of guff from people. So I think it's a really good. So anybody that gets near me, if they've got a 10 to 12 year old girl, I'm like, have she read Harriet the Spy yet?
When we did the program about 6 weeks ago on children's books, that came up again and again and again from a lot of people. So there's a reason for that. It's a great book.
That's a series as well, isn't it?
Well,
she wrote it in 1964. She did write a couple books afterwards. I never was clear if Louise wanted to write them or if her publisher said, hey, you need to keep this story going.
Right.
So, it came out in 64.
Beth in Columbus is on the phone with her life-changing book. Hello, Beth.
Hi.
Go ahead.
You've got me thinking about the other kids' book, from the Crazy Mixed Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankwater.
Yeah, that's a hard title. You got it. Of
course. Yeah. I wanted to live there.
Right.
I just wanted to live there.
Yeah.
The other one that changed my life, I also went to the Art Institute of Chicago, was, and I think I read it while I was there, Firefox by Joyce Carol Oates.
Oh, yeah.
Really? Tell me about it.
Oh, it was intense. It was just like teenage girls who become a girl gang, and I guess it's in the 50s or the 60s, and they're just morally outraged by all the blatant sexism and being flashed and, being molested, that they just kind of make their own group, and they just... the Firefox brand, and they have a brand that they, an actual brand that they put on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember all of it, but it was really good. And it felt empowering as a, 20-something, when people, when a lot of this stuff was going on and nobody talked about it.
That's by Joyce Carol Oates, Firefox?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's Firefox.
It's Foxfire, I think.
Foxfire by Joyce Carol Oates. Very prolific and very wonderful writer, Joyce Carol Oates. Thank you so much, Beth, for that recommendation. If you would like to let us know about the books that changed your life, 614-292-8513. If it's easier, you can shoot us an email. They'll bring it right in, allsides@wosu.org, and then you don't have to talk to me. Karen in Cincinnati is on the line. Hi, Karen.
Hey, actually, it's Taryn with a T.
Taryn, my bad. Okay.
You're fine. It's a common mistake, but Taryn, a book that changed my life, literally. I have dyslexia, and I had started school at the School for Creative and Performing Arts, and then gone on. I went on to the College Conservatory of Music, where I graduated theater school. But I was at the School for Performing Arts and dyslexic and could not stand reading. The book scared me. A teacher put Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns comic book in my hand.
Cool.
I read that, and I said, oh, wow,
Mark Maxwell lit right up when he said that. Yeah,
it's so good.
It's so good, and so it turned me into a reader. And then my grades turned around. My attitude turned towards school turned around. It kind of made the difference.
That's great.
That's Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight Returns
by Frank Miller. Taryn, thank you so much, and good luck with your studies. Thank you for your call. We're talking about the books that changed your life. Mark Maxwell, do you have another one?
Sure. I think when I was in my mid-20s, I read 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. That's a great—I think when you're young, you have a tendency to be kind of solipsistic. You know, everything revolves around you. And I think that book really kind of brought me out of myself and made me see the environment around me as a community. It changed the way I felt about the people around me and my family and stuff, so—
I'm a little embarrassed because the book that first changed my life was Milton Cross's Stories of the Great Operas, for God's sake. But it was. And that was, no, that was.
Never apologize for what you like.
It was an incredible book of stories. And I think I was 8 years old when I picked it up off a library shelf in Lexington, Massachusetts.
Right,
and it kind of changed my life because it was a complete fantasy world. Mm-hmm. Who would think of you know, poisoning your grandmother and singing about it? I mean, it was, and then, but then reading about it in a very serious, well-written adult kind of a way. Mm-hmm. It was, that was something. So I want, Cassie, you're going to chair this discussion at Gramercy Books on October 4th, and you also have a book there called My Life with Bob that I wanted to ask you about, because that's gotten a lot of buzz.
Yes, and this is the book that we're using as a catalyst for that discussion. People don't have to have read it, but it's... it just is a memoir about Pamela Paul's journey with books. And it's interesting because a lot of the chapters are titles of books like Catch 22, The Grapes of Wrath, Brave New World. And she relates them to, like, Brave New World. She says her Brave New World was when she realized how books were like a portal for her into adult life. Mm-hmm. And that she could then begin to start understanding and seeing things that were otherwise locked away from her. Or Catch 22, she became so entrenched with books, she kept buying and buying and buying. It became a catch-22. She had tons of books on her reading table, kept buying more.
No time to read them.
No time to read them. So she takes and she goes through her lifetime. I mean, she's the editor of the New York Times Book Review, and she just shares this lifetime of books that she has kept a catalog of. That is what Bob is. It's a book of books. And she started when she was in high school, I believe, with Bob, writing down manually every book that she has read. And that's what she spins off of with this memoir. And one of the books that changed her life was a book called A Journey of One's Own. And it was a travel book about a woman traveling all over the world and taking great risks. And it changed her life because she was interviewing to work in a corporate position at Quaker Oats, and she wasn't excited about it. And this book literally gave her an idea to think, I can opt out and I'm going to travel. And she does.
That's another great gift of a book like that. It gives you the choice of saying, I don't have to do that, even when you think you kind of do, because you have to eat and you have to pay the rent. But I don't have to do that. Something else will happen because I read about it in a book, or somebody else had that kind of courage. Alex in Columbus has a recommendation or a book that changed Alex's life. Hello, Alex.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So the book that changed my life was The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. And so this was something that my high school biology teacher gave me after my freshman year of high school, and was kind of the first it's nonfiction, obviously. It just describes an evolutionary theory. But it's the first book that kind of laid out a non-teleological worldview and how you can get, like, beautiful, complex patterns arising from simple rules. Some clever ideas can have enormous explanatory power when we look at how we view the world.
The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. Dawkins is somebody who's
famous atheist
writer. He does a lot of on YouTube with him on panel discussions and that are, you know, certainly worth paying attention to. Alex, thank you so much for your recommendation. I appreciate the call. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We're talking not only about the books that change your life, but great books as well. Jim in Columbus has his own recommendation for us. Hi, Jim.
Hello, this is Jim Seymour. How are you?
I'm good. Go ahead.
The book that most changed my life at an early age was Beyond Good and Evil by Friedrich Nietzsche.
Oh, wow.
Basically, I had not heard of Friedrich Nietzsche when I was exposed to it, being the philologist that he was. He exposed the entrails of Christianity for me, showing how where Christianity emerged and basically exposing for me that at heart Christianity was a made-up concoction from human imagination.
Jim, I got 1 minute. Jim, I need you to take the phone away from your mouth a little bit because you're distorting, and I've got about another 30 seconds, so go ahead.
The bottom line is, for me, Nietzsche exposed how absurd Christianity was.
The book is called Beyond Good and Evil by Friedrich Nietzsche. I'm sorry, Jim, but we got a line here. I appreciate the call very much to 292-8513. All Sides Weekend Books is going to take a very quick break, and we will be right back. Don't go away. We are back with today's All Sides Weekend Books. We're talking a lot about books, a lot what's new, what's hot. We're talking about Quick Picks with the Columbus Library and books that changed your life. We have a lot of callers. I have to say, I can only take two more calls on this topic, and I'm going to talk with Chris in Westerville. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, my book would have to be Jane Eyre. Of course, I'm older, but as a young girl.
Me too. I love it.
Yeah, it was just, it set me free. We had kind of a difficult family situation, and I just was feeling completely helpless, and I read that, and I thought I could do anything after reading that. I'll survive.
What age were you when you read Jane Eyre?
Oh, I must have been about maybe 11 or 12.
Wow. Did you read it again as an adult?
Yes. Uh-huh. And I've read all the Brontes, everything they've ever written.
When you read it again as an adult, did it still have that meaning for you that it did when you were a child?
I think it took me back to my childhood and how I felt at that time, and that, yes, I was right. I could survive, and I could do anything and by myself.
I think your call was a gift. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. Jane Eyre was the book that changed Chris's life. I appreciate that call very much. And we can talk to Jim in Columbus. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Go ahead.
All right. I have two for you. Like one of your guests, I also was raised in this small farm community in Ohio. And my first book is The Jungle by Upton Sinclair and Attorney for the Damned by Clarence Darrow, very old books. Mm-hmm. I would say that both of those books were instrumental in changing my political affiliation. I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. No, I'm just curious. I'm always curious when people say that, what age they were when they first encountered those books, because I remember having being a Bostonian, Upton Sinclair wrote a book about called Boston, which is about Sacco and Vanzetti. It's it's a novel. And that made a huge impression on me when I was about 14 or 15 years old. So I'm really glad to hear those two choices, Clarence Darrow and Upton Sinclair
from
Jim in Columbus. Yes, thank you for that. So let's go back to what we have. Let's give me another quick pick from the library. Oh, a big, thick one. Here we go. Dan Brown.
Our buddy Dan Brown. He's finally out with another thriller. So if you've been living in a hole for a while, Dan Brown wrote The Da Vinci Code. I didn't realize it's been 10 years ago he wrote that, 2003. But it wasn't really the first Robert Langdon novel. So that's the one that broke him out. So this one just came out, either last week or this week, I forget. But again, Robert Langdon, for those who forget, Harvard professor, symbology. They've been made into movies.
Tom Hanks,
exactly. So this time he's in Spain. He's at the Guggenheim. And, you know, he's going to have adventures, basically. I did have a customer come into me yesterday, and he had just finished it. And he said, do you know anything about this yet? I said, I actually have not read it. I haven't seen any reviews. He said, I'm really curious to see what people start talking about, because he mentioned there's a religious element in here he thinks that might cause some issues. So I don't know. But, you know, it's a lengthy book. It's over 450 pages, but short chapters. I'm sure the pages are going to turn. I'll probably give it a look because I'm always curious to see what he does. So,
but he's out of Italy and he's away from Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah.
And
now
Last
he's
Supper.
In Spain.
He's in Spain.
Yeah.
Okay.
Origin by Dan Brown.
Well, you know, he is a page turner.
Oh, yeah.
He's like Grisham, and
yeah.
These people are successful for a reason.
Sure.
You know, they are addictive in a wonderful way.
It's sort of like Cassie said. I mean, sometimes you're in the mood for an introspective, moody novel that gets you to think, and sometimes you just want to sit down and flip pages and be taken away someplace else.
When is he going to kiss the girl? When are they going to get
right.
shot at? When is
exactly.
Gonna, yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So I'm a Dan Brown fan, and I remember the Da Vinci Code, the incredible detail. The man must be, he must be a mathematician in some other life. I don't know, but I'm just, he really,
and
I bet
probably
that's,
has
I bet
researchers.
That's a made-up name, too, Dan Brown. I bet his name is, you know.
I don't know. It's hard to say.
More complicated
Who knows,
than
right?
that. Mark Maxwell, what's going on at Half Price Books? And give me another choice of a great read from Mark Maxwell.
Okay, so I brought a mystery novel today. This was recommended to me. We have a long-term employee at our Lane Avenue store named Joe, who gives great, great mystery recommendations. And I think
I'll find him.
Oh, my
is
wife would love him.
White hair?
Yeah. Both Cassie and Robin, I think, are
Joe, okay.
With Joe.
I asked Joe before I left today if it would be okay if I name dropped him, but he recommended to me a couple of weeks ago a book called The Coroner's Lunch by Colin Cotterill, which is probably my favorite book of the year, although it was originally published in 2004. It introduces a character named Dr. Siri Piebone. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. The book is set in Laos right after the revolution. So the royal family has been deposed. The communists are trying to set up a government. This Dr. Siri has been a longtime communist, not because of any ardently held belief, but because he was interested in a girl who was a member of the Communist Party. He is getting up there. He's 72 years old. He is one of the only doctors left in Laos after the revolution, and so they make him the national coroner. he's kind of an interesting character. He's a very reluctant coroner. He very much wants to retire. He's kind of a nonconformist, so he's not necessarily adapting too well to the communist regime. And one day into his morgue comes the wife of a party official who has died under kind of mysterious circumstances. So it's a good mystery, but more than that, it's a wonderful character. Mm-hmm. And it's just a fascinating setting for a mystery novel. Mm-hmm. Colin Cotterill went on to write several more novels featuring that particular mm-hmm. character, and I definitely plan to go on and read them all.
The Coroner's Lunch is the name. And it's
the Coroner's Lunch.
Lunch. You can't beat that for a title.
That's it's amazing.
Yeah, that's great. Good to know. Thank you very much for that. By the way, I walked into the library one day and saw a staff pick. We don't talk about staff picks enough. You have quick picks, which are basically the really popular books that fly off the shelf.
Right.
But each of your branches, we'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, staff picks are great because we do surveys all the time in the world about how do people read and why they read. And one of the key ways people find out about books is through friends and family. So staff picks is a take on that you come in. And what's kind of cool is you can get a following, because like I'll put my books out. And actually we were having a conversation. One of my staff members was talking to somebody and said, hey, have you ever read my picks? And they go, nope, I always look for Robin. So you kind of get a following base. So you realize, oh, this is what this person likes to read. But it's a way to show the individuality of readers. I know bookstores do this too. Mm-hmm. But it's a good way to promote things that people wouldn't normally hear about, because book nerds like us who work in libraries and books read maybe a little deeper. I don't even want to say deeper necessarily, but just a wide range of stuff. And so you're exposed to not just quick picks, but then, hey, what's the staff here read kind of thing. So it's fun. Yeah.
Well, I walked into my branch library and I always look at the staff recommendations at Whetstone, which is a very heavily trafficked branch. Mm-hmm. And there was a book called Defending Jacob. It's a new book by a man called William Landay. And, you know, I'm a sucker. If you're from Boston, I'm a sucker. And he's from Boston. And he's a former DA who is now writing fiction.
Right.
And I just have to say that I couldn't put this book down, and it shocked me.
Yeah.
It has a real twist.
That's when I hand people all the time.
Really?
Yep. I said, you will not see this ending coming.
Yeah. I certainly did. So if you really want to, you know, book that you're sitting in your chair comfortable and you're going to start screaming about five pages from the end, Defending Jacob by William Landay.
Yeah,
I would very much recommend. Has anybody read Mrs. Fletcher by Tom Parada? I think, Cassie, did you recommend that last
time?
No,
you know who? It was Linda Cass. Yeah. And she was here. She had read it. Yes. I've danced around it a little bit. And I keep picking it up, and then I'm like, no. And then
it
I
might
on.
Be a guy book, I'm just saying.
Oh, really?
I read it. I thought it was terrific.
Did you like it?
Terrific.
Yeah.
I thought it was – I like him anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, all the little children. And I mean, I like Tom Parada very much. But, yeah, I recommend that a lot. It's not for everyone.
Yeah.
It's like watching your mother doing things you don't want to see your mother. Right.
Yeah.
But it's really – it's well done. It's very compelling.
I'm like Cassie. I've looked at it. I'm like, no, I'm not going to read that.
No. Could you tell us about Little Fires Everywhere? Because that's getting a huge amount of blowback right now.
Yes, by Celeste Ng. This is her second novel. It takes place in Shaker Heights, Ohio. And it is. It's a very well-done book. You get grabbed by the characters and the family situation. Happens to be there's a mother and her daughter move into Shaker Heights. They rent from the wealthy Richardsons, and the families get involved. And you're... Although I have to, and this is not a spoiler, but in the very beginning, the little fires, I mean, she tells you what they are. And so then she goes into the story about how this mother and daughter move into town. They're artistic, how they get involved with the Richardsons. So the daughter is always over at their house. And the Richardsons are very well off. Both the parents work, beautiful house. Kids are typical teenagers. And what happens and how the artistic framework of or and thinking of the mother and daughter changes the children, how there is also an issue going on, which is a subplot in the town or the township, whereby a Chinese-American baby or a Chinese baby has been adopted by a family, and the mother comes back and says, I want this baby. I want to get it back. She had left it at a fire station. So there's that political pull, that also that controversial issue that Celeste Ng deals with very well. And so you're pulled in it in many different ways. But ultimately, how did the fire start? Why? And she brings it together very well at the end.
What was her previous novel? I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it was about a Vietnamese family living in Ohio as
Chinese
well.
Chinese
family.
Chinese
family.
Everything I Never Told You.
Everything I Never Told You, right. Yeah, so, but this is getting a lot of attention, and I'm curious to know how much, when a book is very heavily promoted and gets into all the big trades and it gets in the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, and people like Cassie Rose are talking about it, is that because it's that good or because it's there's really good stuff behind it?
I'm going to second Cassie and just say she is my favorite author. This is a fabulous book.
But I do have – I think there is a role with it, though. I think that because this is her second book, it was highly anticipated. I think everybody's out grabbing it because I do have to say I think that there are some flaws in this book that surprised me. Mm. I mean, it feels like the author has too heavy of a hand, that in some situations characters appear magically or they do things. It's too convenient. But the overall power of the book – does give you a chance to forgive that. But I was surprised by it. I expected greater excellence. And what happened is that I read Celeste Ng, and then right afterwards I read Jennifer Egan's new book, Manhattan Beach, which is a superior book in my eyes. It's a masterpiece, so well done, so tightly written, and everybody's been anticipating this book too. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting for me to see these very well-known expert writers be reading them back-to-back, and I couldn't help but to see that Celeste Ng did just fall a little bit in this book, but I don't think it damages.
But it's been getting
experience.
Critical handstands, absolute raves everywhere, and I think I'm on number 685 at the library waiting for.
We better make it a quick pick, huh?
You might consider buying it.
Yeah. My problem is, you know, I have so many books and CDs and things. When I'm dead, what's going to happen to them? You know,
right.
That's when I'm praying that age. You know, I have to think about what their future is going to be. I know what mine is. Talk a bit about Manhattan Beach. You were very enthusiastic about it, and Jennifer Egan. Just give us a little more precise about it. What's it about?
Takes place just after Pearl Harbor. It's on the Brooklyn waterfront. A young girl becomes the first female diver with the Navy shipyard on the Brooklyn waterfront. But the overarching story and mystery is what happened to her father. As a little girl, she goes with him to a gangster's house on Manhattan Beach, and shortly after that, her father disappears. So she wants to find out what happened to him, and it's a compelling mystery. And also, it's just that Jennifer Egan she's obviously done her research. She nails it in terms of getting all the details of what it's like during that era, what it's like to be working in a shipyard. And when the young girl, or she's a teenager, becomes this diver, she describes the weight of the suit that they're putting on here and how it weighs like 200 pounds. I mean, this is the 1940s, and how she goes underwater and she loves it, and how she's fixing the American warships. So there's this great story about her and being a very courageous and intelligent young girl. There's the war story going on in the background of what's happening in Europe and the Pacific. But that's all Jennifer Egan does it so well, because the story is not about the war. It's about Anna, her disappeared father, life in Brooklyn, and working in the shipyard.
Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan, mm-hmm. highly recommended by Cassie Rose.
Yes, absolutely.
We're running out of time, and I want Mark Maxwell to give us one more recommendation. You brought a book about a violin.
I did. I brought a book called it's October, and it's Friday the 13th, so I decided to bring something a little weird.
Yeah.
I brought a book called The Incomplete History of the Art of the Funerary Violin by Rohan Krywaczyk. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. This is a book that came out in 2006, and it was a bit of a scandal at the time. So funerary violinists are expert musicians that hire themselves out exclusively for funerals. It's a tradition an obscure tradition that dates back to the Protestant Reformation. Rohan Krywaczyk claims in his introduction that as a young and struggling concert violinist, he was approached and eventually inducted into the Guild of Funerary Violinists, a kind of secretive group of shabby, aging musicians that are keeping this tradition alive. What is interesting about this book is that before it was even published, a number of musicians and music historians came forward to say that it was not true. Rohan Krywaczyk made the whole thing up out of whole cloth. And it was a bit of a scandal at the time. The publisher decided, having already sent an advance, that they were going to just publish it anyway. The book kind of sank into obscurity. But for me, I mean, I love a good scandal.
Is it fiction?
It is. I think of it as fiction.
Was it intended to be fiction? And if so,
the word
who cares
that was
if it
used,
didn't have, it's made
yeah,
up.
The word that was used at the time was hoax. But for me, I mean, I think that that's kind of missing the point. For me, it's a richly realized fictional world with its own characters and rivalries. And at the center, there are these amazing musicians that are struggling with death itself through their art. It's written in a kind of wonderfully dry, sardonic tone with occasional Victorian flourishes, not entirely unlike Lemony Snicket for grown-ups. This book is easy to find. You can go into any local bookstore and find it misshelved in the music history section.
I like it.
And I recommend it a lot
love it
this
already,
time of
just
year.
Just for that reason. That's great. And the title, you can't beat that, The Art of the Funerary Violin.
Indeed.
We thank you very much. I thank all three of you, as always, for a great show today. Cassie Rose, her blog is thelongestchapter.com. She is WOSU's book critic. October 24th, she will be at Gramercy Books. Don't miss that. Mark Maxwell. Go and see Mark Maxwell and say hello. He's almost as handsome as me. He looks like my son or my kid brother. He is sometimes at Lane Avenue. He is the assistant district manager at Half Price Books. And look up the white-haired guy with who's the mystery.
Joe.
Look up Joe as well. Always great to be at Half Price Books. That's really the great book vibe in the city of Columbus. And Robin Nesbitt, read what this woman tells you to read. Robin Nesbitt is branch manager of the Columbus Metropolitan Library in Hilliard. And I'm Christopher Purdy, and I do thank you for being with us today. The All Sides staff includes producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shai Lanott. The All Sides interns are Kyle McKinnon, Courtney Gilbert, Dan Posniak, and Martin Coleman, who brilliantly handles the phones, by the way, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director is Mike Thompson. Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. And Shyla Knott is the star of the show. Thank you all for being here.